From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more.
Arkansans react to police shootings around the country, including the targeting of officers in Dallas, where five were killed.
A look at citizen-initiated proposals that could be on the November ballot.
Governor Asa Hutchinson jets to Europe to seek aviation business for Arkansas.
And the governor again goes before a national radio audience to share his perspective on the race for president. For the week ending Friday, July 8th, 2016, this is KUAR's Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
Jacob Kaufman will also be joining us. That's just ahead. Around the country this week, people were shocked to see graphic police shootings captured on smartphones. And then in Dallas on Thursday night, snipers targeting police officers there with five killed. In Little Rock, people came out to the streets Friday. Jacob, you were out there covering this. First, describe what this demonstration was like.
It was really hot. That's the one thing I can still remember. I can still feel it in my body right now. It was really hot out there. But there's about 200 people or so, maybe, and it seemed like there were a continuous stream of people for about the 2 hours or so this event took place from around 12 to 2. A lot of young people. It was a pretty diverse group, about half white, half black. Lots of young people, lots of women in this. And it was organized by high school students, as I understand it, that had just graduated from Bryant High School. And they just don't have a lot to do during the summer. And they have been responding to the videos, not of the police officers being shot, but of black men being shot by police officers. Here's one of the people that spoke. His name is Zachary Mitchell. He graduated from Central. He's going to Arkansas Baptist College. He kind of made a challenge to his fellow youth.
I feel like my generation should stop using Black Lives Matter as an aesthetic for your Tumblr, for your Instagram, for your Facebook. Stop being an online activist and go out and do something in real life. Please. Because all you're really doing, you're just pushing an issue, but you have no action behind it. And I feel like this generation needs action. You have all these people getting killed, innocent black men getting taken out by police officers that go off record and go off book and still get off. We have well-known white people that do things that get slapped on the wrist, but we end up getting 30 years to life, losing our family, not being able to see the ones we love, and I'm tired of it. I am sick and tired of it.
And that was kind of a theme throughout this protest, calling on people to take up the mantle of leadership in this capacity and on these issues. Here's Latessa Harris. She gave probably it was one of the last speeches. It seemed like it captured people's attention the most. She later would lead these 200 people in a giant circle-like holding of hands on the state capitol grounds in a prayer. But here's her also challenging everyone to lead.
It's time. The switching of the guards has already taken place. Maya Angelou has gone on. Martin Luther King has gone on. Rosa Parks has gone on. Now it's time for us to stand up and take that. They did it in peace, though, and in love. It's not time to take out a gun and start shooting the cops. That's not going to help anything. All it's going to do is make war.
So you can kind of hear everyone's emotion literally overpowering the microphone, creating some distortion into it. But here's this next woman. She was probably the most passionate. People were really captivated by her. Her name is Shirley. She didn't give us the rest of her name, and I saw her walk off immediately after her speech and walk into her car.
I've never been to a rally, never had a mind to go to one, but what I saw on the video last night of this young man getting slaughterly murdered in front of his baby and his girlfriend, I cannot sit back and not come to these rallies. Every time you have one, I will be here. This is so wrong. It is so wrong in every aspect of the word. It is wrong to shoot a man down in front of his baby. And he was still in his seatbelt, for crying out loud. Still in his seatbelt. My God, how can we stand by and just watch people kill human beings like dogs? Dogs got better state than a black man in the United States of America!
So, you know, pretty clearly, you know, everyone is incredibly passionate at that event. Here's the last thing from someone there I'd like to play, if I can find his name real quick. Well, in any event, his name is Mr. McAdoo. He's the son of the former school board member, Reverend Charlie McAdoo. I believe his first name is LaRon. And he tried to make it clear that, you know, this isn't just about us, about people feeling certain things, about people in the protest feeling a certain way, that is all good and fine, but he wants tangible solutions. And to him it is, we've got to make some sort of rules in the police department to make people accountable. It's not, we shouldn't wait for police officers not to be racist.
I'm not looking for an opportunity to change minds, how they think, their paradigm. I'm not looking for an opportunity to change their spirit, have they heart in it. I'm not looking for that. I want the behavior to change. Right. I don't care how they feel. I don't care how they think. I want their behavior to change. Right. And so all I'm going to say is it's past time for change. Black Lives Matter.
So that was pretty much the message. It's pretty united from everyone. There was a speech early on where one young woman said that our first responsibility needs to be to solve black-on-black crime in the community. That's something we can do. The next several speeches pretty much condemn that idea, saying black-on-black crime, white-on-white crime, that's not the issue. The issue is justice with police officers. Those are separate issues.
And was there a police presence at this rally?
Surprisingly, every other protest or event or rally of any kind, celebration, anything I've ever been to at the Capitol has had state police there, or Capitol police officers. Didn't see any of them anywhere. It was like shockingly absent. Though there was one helicopter circling around continuously, I couldn't tell if it was a police helicopter or a media helicopter, and I consulted several other reporters, and we couldn't quite distinguish the markings on it.
Well, there has been a call for calm from Governor Asa Hutchinson. He talked with Talk Business and Politics before getting ready to depart for a trip to Europe.
Most importantly, we need to make sure that we talk with reason and discipline as we discuss these matters, and leaders should not be encouraging and dramatizing the response beyond what it should be. The key thing here is our commitment to the rule of law. Our law enforcement officers do an extraordinary job out there keeping our society civil, making sure that we're safe in our streets and protecting ourselves. Yes, they make mistakes. Yes, we need to concentrate on training. And yes, we need to make sure we get rid of anyone who, you know, uses excessive force. Absolutely those things. But on both sides, you know, we need to support the rule of law and hold people accountable when they make those mistakes. What happened in each of these cities is tragic. Most recently, what happened in Dallas just goes beyond the pale to think that law enforcement officers with families, with loved ones that support our community and really protecting a civil protest are targeted and attacked really undermines everything we're about in America. And so my heart goes out to them, and we obviously want to know more as to, you know, the reasons and whether this goes beyond simply a Dallas targeting. So there's a lot to watch here, a lot of work to be done. I've talked to Colonel Bryant, and obviously whenever you have peaceful protests, we support that. And that's what they were doing in Dallas. That was a peaceful protest. And they were as much a victims of this as those in law enforcement, but the law enforcement was targeted. So let's pray for them and support our law enforcement and support more training as well.
The Little Rock Police Department had a press conference scheduled for this afternoon. Have we heard anything about what they had to say?
I haven't. I was at this other rally at the same time that the Little Rock Police Department conference was going on. However, earlier in the day on Twitter, they, as well as the Pulaski County Sheriff's Association, sent out several messages and just generally in support of police officers in Dallas, not really mentioning the Black Lives Matter movement. That one thing that is interesting about all the state officials that you just mentioned is that all of them, without being prompted, sent out statements about the shooting of the police officers in Dallas. Clearly, they see that as a tragedy. Everybody sees it as a tragedy. But these Black Lives Matter protesters were there not so much for that incident, but for two other killings that have got popular attention in the national media in the past week, and none of our elected officials said anything about those shootings at all. Diane Curry, however, the Democratic candidate running against French Hill, was at this rally.
Chris, the most recent incident we had with police where a suspect was shot on 12th Street, and you had a lot of people come out, and it's the closest recent event, any kind of civil unrest reacting to a police shooting. You went out there and covered that. It seemed like police were able to calm that situation down. What was that, about a year and a half ago?
Yeah, there was like 2 years ago or so on 12th Street, police pulled over a man in an SUV that they thought was stolen, although it later turned out that it was not stolen. And I believe the man ran from the vehicle, and I think he was armed at that time, and he did have drugs, but there was a chase, and he was shot, and this happened kind of right by a commercial area, like you said, on 12th Street. About 100 to 200 people kind of spontaneously came out onto the street, and just some of them, you know, made kind of quickly made some signs and stuff, you know, just kind of just in anger, basically. It was not violent at all. There was no destruction of any property or anything. But I remember those people, they stayed out there for, I don't know, pretty much. I mean, it happened in the latter part of the morning, and there were people out there until the early evening. And I remember the police chief at the time, is before Kenton Buckner's reign, but he later came out there and addressed media who was present. People were certainly angry. It had happened pretty soon after the Trayvon Martin incident in Florida with George Zimmerman, an unarmed black teenager who was just going home to his dad's house, was followed by a neighborhood watchman, and shot dead. And it also happened shortly after the trial of a Little Rock teenager who was
unarmed. Bobby Moore III?
Yeah, Bobby Moore III, who he was maybe a 15 or 16-year-old black teenager who, with some friends, had, I think, broken into some cars at an apartment complex or something.
He was going in reverse when the police officer approached him, Josh Hastings, who was a son of a former public information officer for the police department.
Yeah.
But that trial had just been completed.
It had ended in a mistrial, and there was no verdict served. But that teenager, he was unarmed, and there were people holding signs at the time, invoking his name, Bobby Moore, and it was that was right at the beginning of what we call the Black Lives Matter movement. That's when the movement was really starting to, this kind of feeling of anger in black communities across the nation was really starting to ramp up, and that was evidence of it at the time. But like I said, it wasn't violent. It was peaceful. People were certainly angry and yelling.
Did police do anything in particular to calm or diffuse the situation?
Other than just to make sure that, nothing happened. I mean, there was definitely an increased police presence afterwards. And I remember there, more than a dozen officers, lining up and down 12th Street, just kind of monitoring the situation. And of course, a lot of the protesters were exchanging words with the police. I think from what I recall, most of the police didn't really respond. They just kind of stood there. And it's interesting. I mean, when, those kinds of incidents happen, they seem so spontaneous, but at the same time, it's a feeling that's been, and I remember talking with some people, who are at protesters, and even though in that particular instance, the man was armed, he was pulled over, erroneously, it turned out. And, people just had this general sense of constant police presence, and they felt a lot, many felt that they were being targeted unfairly in terms of being pulled over and also being questioned and stuff by police.
And there's now a bright new shiny police substation, like just down the road from that. Right?
They're on 12th
Street.
Yeah.
And that, I think that, you know, had a, you know, that that certainly was part of the police department's response to incidents like that and trying to get more of a communication or dialogue with the community by having a presence.
Yeah,
in the community.
And so that was brought up. I had covered the groundbreaking for that a new substation there, and that was part of what police were saying then, too. It's an effort for us to be more in the community, because a lot of people say the police just kind of speed by in their cars and don't actually get out, talk with people, have a real relationship with the community.
But I just wanted to, like Chris said, I wanted to make sure this is clear, that this thing I was at today, there was no way any reason to like describe it as anything other than a rally like any other rally. The only reason I think we're even talking about protests is because we're kind of viewing it through this racial lens a little bit. I mean, it was just a rally like any other rally that ever happens there. People were very passionate. It wasn't chaotic at all. This is clearly a subject and an issue that's not going to go away. As Chris said, these aren't spontaneous instances necessarily, although each shooting or each incident seems like it comes out of nowhere. I think most of the people, at least at this rally, they've connected all these dots to be a system of oppression.
Governor Asa Hutchinson is traveling this weekend to Europe, where next week he has a number of meetings with several businesses, mainly those in the aviation industry, working to nurture the state's relationships with different companies that are doing business in the state, as well as some that they would like to lure. He'll also then be traveling to Germany. KUAR's Sarah Weitz-Kodacek joins me now with that. Sarah, you spoke with the governor before he departed. What are his plans?
He says, don't expect an announcement of any deals next week, but this is laying the groundwork. He's introducing himself and helping European investors put Arkansas on the map in their minds. Some of the selling points he's working on are, you know, Arkansas centrally located. There's a river here, and the state has a history of manufacturing, hardworking people. So he is going to show up along with our neighboring states and have a presence at the air show.
So this is in England. And let's hear a little of what he had to say. Any setup needed?
No.
The focus, of course, in the air show would be those that are in aeronautics, you know, our defense of our country. We already have a good presence here with Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Camden, South Arkansas. We've got, you know, obviously a Dassault Falcon jet here in Little Rock with 2,000 employees. And so we want to showcase the foundation that we have here in Arkansas. And without me being there, there's four or five governors from other states that are there. They're going to be showcasing their states, Alabama and others. So we don't want Arkansas to be a no-show. So our target is, again, some new businesses that might be possibilities down the road. But also, we have some opportunities for expansion or location of headquarters here from other companies that we want to talk to.
What kind of advantages can Arkansas offer to compete with a state like Mississippi or Alabama or any other southern state?
Well, it's first of all our workforce. I want to showcase that we have a computer coding initiative that's very important in sophisticated technological manufacturing. Secondly, we've got a history of manufacturing in this state. We're about number six in the nation in the percent of our workforce engaged in manufacturing. That really shows a history, a capacity, hardworking, willingness to do what's necessary in manufacturing. Secondly, it's logistics. You know, you're looking at a European audience. Not everybody knows exactly where Arkansas is. And we're in the center point of the United States with an opportunity to reach two-thirds of the market right here in Arkansas with access to river navigation as well as, you know, land transportation. So all that we have here in this state, I think, gives us a competitive edge. At least allows us to be competitive with the other states.
And then he's heading to Germany, where Arkansas is opening an office. There are about 20 businesses with investors in Germany already investing in Arkansas. The governor said this will serve all of Europe, and he's hoping especially that it will be a new point for UK
investors to develop new kinds of independent relationships with the state now that they've left the union.
And this will be the third international office for the state with others in China and Japan. Any word what this office will encompass, what they'll really be doing?
I think it's going to be an office to work with businesses existing in Germany and also trade partners across Western Europe that are negotiating deals with Arkansas. So I guess just to facilitate communication and on-the-ground presence there.
And then he and the delegation are to return to Arkansas on Thursday. Then in the coming weeks, the governor will be among the Arkansas delegation at the Republican National Convention. It's interesting, Sarah, how Governor Hutchinson has periodically been going back to Robert Siegel of NPR's All Things Considered to weigh in on the presidential race. And on Thursday, he spoke for a third time on All Things Considered. The first interview he had earlier in the year was supporting Mike Huckabee and sharing his concerns about Donald Trump. The second interview, he was backing Marco Rubio. And at that time, he kind of stepped up his condemnation of Trump, calling his words scary, but still saying he would back the eventual nominee. And then Thursday, you were there. You kind of engineered it on the Arkansas end as he was interviewed by Robert Siegel from Washington, but now kind of supporting Donald Trump.
Yeah, NPR seems to have picked Governor Hutchinson as a litmus test of a Southern Republican governor and how he's negotiating Trump's popularity. He called Trump frightening with Robert Siegel a few months ago, and every time I've sat in on these interviews, the conversation shifts slightly, although the questions remain the same. So Hutchinson, this week, he was saying, you know, it's a matter of style is what it comes down to, and he doesn't agree with Trump's style. But in the end, there's still the whole Republican Party infrastructure and all of the staff members and the Supreme Court appointees, and he made a sports analogy and, you know, said he's playing defense for the Republican Party and doesn't matter, you know, he's on the team. It's funny, I actually, some of his policy advisors were chatting with him before the conversation, and he was kind of getting his talking points together, and they were saying, you know, pivot to Clinton. We've already talked enough about Trump, and they were discussing this a 6-point star tweet that Trump put out last weekend with reference to Clinton that many people claimed was anti-Semitic, and whether, you know, Robert Siegel was going to bring that up and what they should say. But basically, they decided, you know, we're playing offense now, I guess, not just defense.
Yeah, and really, the key was, he's better than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and he didn't go into much detail this time as to why, but what I took from it was that they see the party as being much bigger than the president, and they seem to think that the president is limited, really. The presidency is limited, and they're looking at a bigger picture for their party. So whatever Trump does that bothers Hutchinson, it's not enough to be worse than Democrats.
The governor points out here at the beginning that he really hasn't changed the fact that he said he would support the nominee. He has said that all along and is still kind of going along with that.
You know, I was wondering about that because it seemed like maybe by conversation number two with Robert Siegel, he was saying things like Trump still needs to prove himself to me. And at that point, obviously, he wasn't the nominee, but Hutchinson has held out and not necessarily indicated, yes, he's with Trump no matter what. And now he's saying, yes, I support the nominee. So,
well, here's the conversation that Governor Hutchinson had with NPR's Robert Siegel on Thursday.
Since February, I've been checking in with Asa Hutchinson about the Republican presidential race. Hutchinson is the Republican governor of Arkansas. He used to be a congressman and was later head of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Governor, thanks for joining us once again.
Good to be with you.
Over the months, we've heard you express support, first for your fellow Arkansan Mike Huckabee when he dropped out for Marco Rubio. Each time you expressed some real reservations about Donald Trump. But since then, you've made your peace with supporting Mr. Trump. Why? What happened?
Well, I always said that I would support the nominee of the party, and just because my quarterback didn't get selected by the coach, I'm not going to stop blocking for the team. And I think it is important whenever you look at the contrast of Hillary Clinton and the what she offers our country versus a Republican leadership team. The nominee of our party, which at this is presumed to be Donald Trump, I think that's the right team to support. That's what I've always said I would.
In previous interviews, you've told me you had real misgivings about Trump's trade policy, his lack of seriousness in discussing issues, his divisiveness, what you called his frightening words about building a wall that Mexico will pay for. Are you now satisfied on all those counts?
No. In fact, when I've visited with Mr. Trump, I told him there are things I disagree with you, and I will continue to articulate differences as needed, but I'm convinced that this is the best opportunity to take our country in the right direction. I hope to use my influence to shape his policies and the direction he goes. I hope in terms of trade, and we do have some disagreements there, that this is a good negotiating position that he has, that he's reflecting really what America is concerned about is a tougher stance on trade. I don't want to stop and build protectionism out there, but I certainly don't mind tough negotiation with our trade partners.
Let me to pick up on divisiveness, though, which is something that you raised with me in a previous interview. This week, Trump's social media staff took down an image of a six-pointed star over a bed of $100 bills after it was cited as an anti-Semitic image. He came back this week and said they shouldn't have taken it down. They shouldn't have given in to what he called partisan political correctness. Was that an instance of diminishing division in our country, or was that an instance of increasing division?
Well, I think it's just an instance where we're getting distracted from the important issues that we ought to be talking about.
But he returned to it. He returned to the issue himself. Is he distracting the party from things it might find stronger issues to talk about?
Well, he has a style that is not my style, and that is fine. That's Donald Trump, and guess what? That's exactly who the base of the Republican Party supported and said that's who we want to carry the banner. And so if you talk about divisiveness, I think you also have to talk about Hillary Clinton and the fact that, you know, whenever she has her own controversies with the FBI report that comes out, whenever you have the fact that she will really be carrying on the third term of the Obama administration, this is the difference between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump. And I have no question but that a Trump presidency would take us in the right direction.
But before you go, can you just tell me, in a nutshell, if it's a successful Republican convention in Cleveland, which I assume you'll be at in the Arkansas delegation, what in a word will be achieved?
Oh, that the American people will see a Trump presidency as to how it is different from a Clinton presidency, a difference in direction, where there's a stark choice, and secondly, that they will see the strength of not just Donald Trump, but the Republican team that would lead our country.
Do the stay-at-home Republicans undermine that very argument by not showing up and not showing we are one party and we're all together on this?
Well, it's actually disappointing. Obviously, everybody can't go to the convention, but if you're staying away from the convention because you disagree with the style or some substance of Donald Trump, that's a mistake because we've got our country at stake, and I fully believe that this is a time where you shape the direction of how Republican leadership would take this country and not to abandon ship and say we're not going to have anything to do with it.
Asa Hutchinson, Governor of Arkansas, thanks for talking with us once again.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And there the governor talking with NPR's Robert Siegel on All Things Considered Thursday. Well, Chris, as we record our podcast, today, Friday, is the deadline for backers of proposed initiatives and constitutional amendments to turn in signatures to the Secretary of State's office. And on Thursday, backers of one of two medical marijuana proposals got word that they had enough valid signatures to make it on the ballot. I spoke with Melissa Fault. She's campaign director of the group Arkansans for Compassionate Care.
We did get official news that we are certified for the ballot with 77,516 valid signatures, which is nearly 10,000 over the required number. Absolutely fabulous.
What do you plan?
A little concerned, though, because we are begging and pleading with David Couch and Jason Polk to please withdraw theirs. we know from all the statistics that one or the other will pass, but if they are both on the ballot, they will both more than likely fail. So our efforts and works can actually go down the tubes because all of the political analysts, both national groups and the ones here in the state, have all done the statistics and all show that the likelihood of both of them being on the ballot and either one passing are minimal.
Why is that?
Well, what happens is it's going to confuse the voters, number one, and they'll just get frustrated and either will vote no on both of them or, you know, some will vote for his, some will vote for ours. It gets very confusing, and the opponents are going to vote against all of them. And so it's going to split the votes, and it will cause both of them to fail. And it's heartbreaking because our volunteers have worked tirelessly for 2 years to gather these signatures and have done an amazing job. So it's pretty heartbreaking. It's exciting that we've made the ballot, but it's very heartbreaking that he still intends to turn in.
And just to be clear there, the other ballot proposal that she's referring to by David Couch, that's the second medical marijuana proposal. The first one, the one that Fultz is leading, Arkansans for Compassionate Care, would allow people with a note from their doctor to get marijuana from a dispensary. If they live further than 20 miles away from a dispensary, then they would be allowed to grow their own. The second proposal there from David Couch, who, by the way, turned in signatures on Friday, said he believes he does have enough to make it on the ballot. He needs a little more than 84,000 signatures, but his, Chris, mainly uses the business end of it, dispensaries. And you have those two, as well as a third one, a recreational proposal that all are vying for the ballot. At this point, we don't know about the recreational proposal.
It appears that I don't think they have enough signatures. I have not seen anything about them turning in signatures today. Also, I mean, these two medical marijuana proposals, I mean, I've seen canvassers for those, paid canvassers at gas stations, downtown at the River Market, pretty much every event for the last couple of months seeking signatures. And one important thing to know is that, you know, the Melissa Fultz's initiated act, they turned in around 117,000 signatures, and I think only 77,000 of those were validated. So
right.
It kind of shows you kind of the monumental task that a lot of these groups have in getting the signatures. In fact, I talked to a woman with the Secretary of State's office, and they have the job of validating all these, verifying them. This is Carrie Baldwin, and this will be two. She's here commenting on like all the things that could invalidate signatures when the petitions are handed in.
If it's not an original, that's one. If it's not signed by a canvasser is another one. If the canvasser did not put their address on the signature page, if the canvasser didn't verify a date earlier than the date of anything, if it's not notarized, if it's lacking a notary seal, there's just so many different things that we look at.
And all those could invalidate like an entire page of signatures, even if, you know, they are registered voters. But the good thing about the law is that groups are allowed to gather more signatures if they meet the initial threshold. They can, and some are invalidated below that threshold. Say, you know, David Couch's group needs 85,000. If only 70,000 are invalidated, they get 30 more days to seek some more. The other difference between those two proposals is Melissa Fultz's amendment is an initiated act, which is something that could be overturned by the legislature. And the David Couch medical marijuana amendment is a constitutional amendment, which can only be overturned by a vote of the people. So we'll see, you know, what comes about with those.
And it's worth also the opposing side on this. There have been several different voices that have come out in opposition to the marijuana proposals. Jerry Cox with the Family Council put out a statement saying the one that was approved on Thursday to go on the ballot was written so broadly, I'm reading his words here, was written so broadly that virtually any healthy adult with pain and nausea would be able to finagle a way to use marijuana. Said it's not really prescriptions, just a note from the doctor. The state surgeon general said that if there are medical benefits, he argues it should be done through pharmaceutical companies and drugstores the same way your regular medications are done.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if this other medical marijuana amendment is also approved to be on the ballot, what the rest of Arkansas's medical community will have to say about this. But moving on, there are other constitutional amendments that are trying to reach the deadline to turn in signatures on Friday, today, as we record this. For instance, there's a group of five or six people who are in this group called Arkansas Wins for 2016. And they're trying to push an amendment that would establish three casinos in Arkansas counties, in Washington, Boone, and Miller counties, or one casino each in Washington, Boone, and Miller counties. If you know anything about the geography of the state, Washington County is northwest Arkansas, Boone County is north central Arkansas, and Miller County is southwest Arkansas around Texarkana. These casinos would be allowed to operate alongside, you know, now we have Oaklawn and Hot Springs, which is in central Arkansas, and Southland over in West Memphis, of course, in the western part of the state. This Arkansas Wins group said they expected to turn in their required number of signatures, the 85,000 or so needed by today, although we don't have official word yet as we record this if they did. I did speak with Robert Kuhn. He's a spokesperson for the group. That he actually was hired by them. He works for Impact Management, which is a kind of consulting public affairs firm. And here he is kind of commenting on, like I was saying, the kind of geography or the choice of placing these casinos in certain places.
We kind of looked at what the state already has as far as gaming inside the state, right? Which, you know, we've got a gaming facility in eastern Arkansas at Southland, and then there's gaming down in Oaklawn in Garland County in the center part of the state. And, you know, there's certainly a limit on how much, you know, you can oversaturate one market. So part of the thinking was let's look at areas of the state where we wouldn't be oversaturating.
So their basic point is economic development. And they did announce a partnership with the Cherokee Nation to, if this amendment were to pass in November and get approved and passed in a vote of the people, the Cherokee Nation would operate the casino in Washington County, which actually borders the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, in the west. Another constitutional amendment proposal is one by a group called Healthcare for Arkansans, and it's unclear whether they have the signatures needed, but this would basically, it's kind of a quote-unquote tort reform law that would put a minimum on the number of, on the amount of non-economic damages, awards, on the amount of awards for non-economic damages in medical lawsuits, basically termed as pain and suffering. It would set a minimum at $250,000, and it would allow the legislature to set the maximum award for medical lawsuits. So it gives the legislature more power in that regard. It also restricts attorneys' fees for people filing medical lawsuits. This is put forward by a former state representative, Dan Greenberg, Republican. He also operates this conservative think tank based here called the Advanced Arkansas Institute.
And one thing that we will not be seeing on the ballot is a proposal to put further term limits in place.
Yeah, there was a group, Arkansas Term Limits, who had been advocating for stronger term limits for legislators to increase them after, in 2014, voters passed an ethics reform bill, which also had some that actually extended the limits, the term limits for legislators, and that kind of irked this group. But they didn't have enough signatures as of last week. They only had about 50,000 and they needed 85,000. And so they suspended their campaign, they announced.
All right, Chris Hickey, thanks very much.
No problem.
Well, with that, we'll wrap up this week's podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
On behalf of Jacob Kaufman and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, thanks very much for listening. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. KUAR is a listener-supported, editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock.